The Burt Cohen Show, Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
It's The Burt Cohen Show. America has been involved in a whole bunch of wars over time now, hasn't it? And maybe another one coming up. I mean, we've had the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, Libya, and now there's a lot of talk about something maybe going on in the much larger non-Arab country of Iran. A lot of people don't know what's going on there, but my goodness, there's an awful lot of saber rattling going on. Israel is certainly very much involved. There's talk about developing nuclear bombs. It's interesting, it's scary, and there are politics involved. What a surprise. Well, here we're going to talk about what's going on with all the talk of war escalating in Iran, and with us on the Burt Cohen Show today, I'm very pleased to have John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, on February 2nd, the Washington Post reported that the chief of the Pentagon, Leon Panetta, said he believes that Israel is likely to attack Iran in 2 to 4 months. If Iran is indeed developing a nuclear bomb, doesn't the state of Israel have a defensive responsibility to attack?
Well, Israel definitely thinks that it has the right to attack Iran. It has, of course, attacked other countries in the past to take out their nuclear capabilities. And it believes that we are fast approaching what it calls the zone of immunity. In other words, it believes that Iran's nuclear program will soon pass a point of no return, beyond which it will be impossible to actually attack it. In other words, that it will have a hardened site underground that will be resistant to even the strongest bunker buster type bombs. But there is considerable disagreement with Israel's analysis of what's going on inside Iran, and that disagreement comes from the United States as well, disagreement about where Iran is with its nuclear program as well as the appropriate responses to that program.
Now, Iran, which I don't know if they speak with one unified voice, which is true for Israel as well, and I definitely want to get to that, the government of Iran at least claims that they're just doing it for nuclear power. Now, of course, I'm not a big fan of nuclear power, but there's a huge difference between developing nuclear power to generate electricity and developing a bomb. Quite a few questions come up with that. With all that oil in Iran, why would they need to generate electricity through nuclear fission?
Well, the nuclear program in Iran goes back many decades. In fact, it was developed under the previous regime of the Shah, and was helped by the United States through its Atoms for Peace program.
Oh, yeah.
And nuclear power was considered an important attribute of a modernizing nation, that any country that hoped to kind of prepare itself for the 21st century and prepare itself for a time when fossil fuels were no longer available would, of course, have a nuclear power program. So that program was basically adopted by the successor Islamic Republic that took over in 1979 after the Iranian Revolution. And that government, too, sees the nuclear program as a kind of important attribute of modern society, but also of a strong economic power. And as you said, there is a big difference between nuclear power for civilian use and nuclear power for military use. However, it can be difficult to tell from the outside whether a country has moved from one to the other. In other words, it's, in the case of uranium enrichment, a matter of the degree of enrichment. And if you have a facility that's hidden from view, in which you're enriching beyond the point that would be necessary for simply civilian use, that would mean that you've passed the threshold without anybody necessarily knowing. And of course, this was in part the case with North Korea as well, although North Korea developed its nuclear material, at least initially, through plutonium, through the plutonium path rather than uranium enrichment. But Iran has the advantage from our point of view, perhaps a disadvantage from its point of view, of having having inspectors there from the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, that have made periodic visits, have monitored all of the extant facilities, but there again is some disagreement about what is going on in some of those facilities. So the disagreement right now between the IAEA and Iran is a question of transparency, whereas Israel sees it really as a more fundamental disagreement between whether Iran is on the civilian path or on a military path.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with John Pfeffer, who's written quite a bit about foreign policy, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, about what's going on in Iran. And so the IAEA, are they not able to verify one way or the other whether the nuclear development, the uranium enrichment is headed for civilian use or for military use? Are they not able to determine that?
Well, they have released a number of reports over the years, beginning with one in 2003 in which they basically argued that Iran had a secret enrichment program for many years.
So the IAEA was saying that?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Now, of course, the United States had determined through its intelligence assessments that Iran had basically abandoned its attempt to create a military nuclear program in 2003, basically around the time of the Iraq War. So there was disagreement about, of course, whether Iran abandoned that or didn't abandon that in 2003. But in any case, you know, Iran is a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and therefore it's subject to IAEA inspections and safeguards.
Right.
But what that means is the IAEA sends a delegation over to Iran and takes the reports from its inspectors and asks a series of questions. And so its reports over the last year have raised certain questions about uranium enrichment facilities, about the possible testing of nuclear components, in other words, that would be part of a nuclear weapon. And it's asked Iran for clarification, and it hasn't gotten clarification, you know, sufficient to dispel from the IAEA's point of view its concerns. So that's basically where we are with the IAEA, but the disputes between the United States and Iran, between Iran and Israel, they in some sense go beyond this question of transparency.
Yeah, and I wanted to explore that. You've written that there's some kind of it kind of fits in with some greater game. I mean, Afghanistan, Lord knows, has been struggled over for years and years, and I believe it was Winston Churchill, I hope I'm not wrong, who called it the graveyard of empires. And, you know, Afghanistan actually borders Iran, does it not? And how, you know, aside from the nuclear thing, or is the nuclear issue, you know, part of a bit of a pawn in this much larger game?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you point out, the great game of the 19th century, very early part of the 20th century, was basically a competition among empires for control of Central Asia. And Afghanistan was kind of at the heart of Central Asia. And it figured in kind of several multi-layers. One layer, of course, was geopolitical and control over what was called the Eurasian heartland. It was believed that whatever empire controlled the Eurasian heartland would be able to control the vast stretch from England all the way to Japan and become essentially the world superpower.
Mm-hmm.
Another was control over emerging energy resources. Especially at the beginning part of the 20th century. Another was preventing Russia, which was expanding through much of the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
from reaching to a warm water port. Now, of course, Russia did have a warm water port in Crimea on the Black Sea,
right.
but it was of limited strategic value since all Russian ships would have to go through the rather narrow Dardanelles.
Mm-hmm.
Through what was then the Ottoman Empire, and so therefore it didn't have the kind of independent warm water port that it desired, and so Afghanistan was seen as a stepping stone for Russia's southward advance. And so all of those factors kind of contributed to this jostling among the various empires. Now, of course, all those empires collapsed with World War I, and you had a very different kind of great game emerging in the 20th century. What we see now with Iran is, again, this similar kind of multiple layers. We have an energy great game who will control the great energy resources of Central Asia,
mm-hmm.
Which includes, of course, the oil production in Iran, but also natural gas and oil production throughout Central Asia and the pipelines that are necessary to get that oil and natural gas to the West, to Europe,
mm-hmm.
also to the East, to China and to India. You have a great game as well over Iranian influence. Now, there's been thousands of years of competition, for instance, between the Arab world and the Persian world, and Iran, as you point out, is non-Arab. But today we see kind of the latest version of that, for instance, in Iraq and in Syria, where Iran has its interests and it has its allies, and it faces off against its major challengers in the Sunni world, Iran, of course, being Shiite, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. And so that's another layer of the great game. And then finally, we have the face-off between the United States and Iran. Of course, Iran and the United States were great allies during the Shah period.
Right.
But after the Islamic Revolution of 1979, Iran became one of the great adversaries of the United States. And so we have a very pointed competition between the United States and Iran for influence as well.
Wow, it's some big issues, certainly, and Israel, the state of Israel, is certainly, it's kind of central to it. And so there's, you know, what you're talking about is certainly one very important layer, perhaps the most important layer. Israel, you know, is surrounded by a bunch of Arab states that are not usually real friendly to it. They had an ally in Egypt for quite some time, less so now. And Israel is, I believe, a nuclear nation. It's part of the club that has nuclear weapons. And I guess they want to stay that way. And should they not be concerned and start to think about it? I mean, it's kind of understandable why Israel, which is, you know, Iran is not leading their cheerleaders. They're not on good terms, to put it mildly. Isn't there a risk to Israel if they don't launch a preemptive attack to wipe out and to, you know, have some bombs go deep into the ground? And they've done it before, as you say. I believe they blew out a developing nuclear facility in Iraq. Why shouldn't they do it now?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you point out, Israel is a, in some ways, an undeclared nuclear power, although it has has made statements in recent years strongly suggesting that they have a nuclear arsenal.
Oh, yeah.
But they're not a member of the NPT, so they are not, and nor have they had a kind of breakout in the way that India and Pakistan have with a formal test of a nuclear weapon. And Israel has been perpetually concerned about its existence, and it right. for many folks in Israel, though not all, developed a kind of a garrison mentality in which the country is surrounded on all sides by hostile forces. But if we look at the situation between Israel and Iran, it's a somewhat more complex relationship. Now, many folks point out that, you know, Ahmadinejad, the leader of Iran, has taken a specifically negative attitude toward Israel, has vowed to wipe Israel off the map, but that is really a kind of mistranslation of what Ahmadinejad said. What Ahmadinejad and the Iranian government is unhappy with is the kind of government in Israel today. And they're particularly worried about the right-wing leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with the kind of formulation you put, why shouldn't Israel just take out the nuclear program now and eliminate what might be a major threat in the future, is that that act would in fact precipitate precisely the kind of scenario that Israel wants to avoid. In other words, it would lead to possible direct attack by Iran or by its proxies or allies, Hezbollah and Hamas, lead to a kind of overall upsurge of anti-Israeli sentiment in the region more generally, mm-hmm. might draw the United States into the conflict and enlarge it beyond just what would ordinarily be considered a surgical attack on a nuclear project.
Right.
And it's for these reasons, frankly, that quite a few voices inside Israel are cautioning against such a nuclear strike against a nuclear project in Iran. And these aren't just voices coming from the peace movement. These are voices coming from the former leaders of the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service. So these are what would ordinarily be considered hawkish voices in Israel, but they recognize that a strike against the nuclear program in Iran would have dire consequences for Israel.
We are talking with John Pfeffer, co-director of foreign policy in Focus, trying to get a focus on the dangers in Iran. How much power does Benjamin Netanyahu have in Washington? It seems, it appears, that he, through his ally AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, has tremendous power in Washington that specifically for Benjamin Netanyahu, not necessarily, I mean, Israel is, as I understand it, has a lot of political parties and a tremendous amount of disagreement within, you know, healthy democratic disagreement, but that Netanyahu really has a lot of power in Washington, not just with Republicans, but with Democrats as well. And certainly there's a long tradition since the creation of Israel in 1948 of the United States working hand in glove with this state of Israel. So I wonder if you could talk about the power of Netanyahu in Washington. Maybe he has more power in Washington than he does in Israel and AIPAC as well.
Yeah, well, you're right. You know, the United States and Israel have long had a very strong relationship going back to Truman and FDR before that, of course. And, you know, the United States has committed itself to working to preserve the state of Israel.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that has had different interpretations about what the United States should do in order to defend Israel. And obviously AIPAC, which has emerged as basically the lobbying group for Israeli interests here in the United States, has taken a more conservative or hawkish view of how the United States should interpret this alliance. It's not the only view. I mean, in recent years, of course, we've seen the emergence of a more liberal kind of Jewish lobby called J Street that has countered many of AIPAC's arguments about what the United States should do. But AIPAC has been influential in terms of courting both Republicans and Democrats. It has gone to the far right of the political spectrum here to work with evangelicals, and it has also worked with liberal Democrats, where especially liberal Democrats who come from constituencies where there are large numbers of Jewish voters. So even though, you know, if you take a kind of poll of what Jewish public opinion here is in the United States about international affairs or about Israel more specifically, you'll find that there's quite a wide gap between where most American Jews are on foreign affairs and where AIPAC is. AIPAC is nevertheless able to kind of leverage its own position in Washington to make itself seem representative of American Jewish opinion. Now, where does Netanyahu come in this? Well, Netanyahu is kind of the dream candidate for AIPAC. I mean, they've been waiting for many years to have someone who is kind of unabashedly right-wing, unabashedly hawkish on issues. You know, it thought that it had, you know, kind of previous Israeli leaders like that, like Sharon, but even Sharon proved to be quite conciliatory on a number of issues with regard to the Palestinians and so forth. But Netanyahu has proven to be conciliatory on no issues, especially on questions like Israeli settlements, relationship with Hamas in Gaza Strip or with the Palestinian Authority more generally. He is a no-compromise kind of guy. And AIPAC has kind of taken this opportunity to present Netanyahu as the voice of Israel, even though, as you point out, there is quite a range of public opinion and political opinion, both in Israel and in the Israeli government. And so when Netanyahu has come here and addressed Congress, he probably got more applause than you would have found he would get in a speech in Israel. And it was kind of influential, both his response to statements by President Obama on Israel. It was quite interesting the extent to which Netanyahu's phrasing, Netanyahu's kind of interpretation of events in Israel and in the Middle East had a direct kind of impact on President Obama and President Obama's attempt to kind of put the United States forward as usual as a middleman on this issue.
Yeah. Now, there's so many political aspects here as well, and the power of Netanyahu probably can hardly be overstated. In the United States, you have people like Lieberman who unfortunately are still in the U.S. Senate, I believe.
He's going to step down.
Hasn't done it yet. Not soon enough. Everybody, it seems all the political real players, as opposed to, you know, the people who disagree with President Obama and with the Republicans, they all want to show, oh, no, I'm a better friend of Israel. No, I'm a better friend of Israel. And just trying to one-ups them, you know, manship all the time. You know, we have Romney, Santorum, and Gingrich. Each one of those seems to be trying to be tougher than the other on Iran. How have what they have been saying escalated the danger of perhaps the U.S. inadvertently getting involved in a rather large, potentially nuclear war?
In general, between kind of the position of Iran about its own program and the position of Israel about Iran's program, the Obama administration, generally speaking, has staked out a middle position. As I said, the national intelligence estimates that have been produced, the last two, suggest that Iran has not embarked on a nuclear program that's military in nature. And the Obama administration in general has been cautious in its assessments. Now, of course, the Obama administration has also backed sanctions against Iran. And again, this is an attempt to give the IAEA greater access to the country, to have more information about what's going on with the nuclear program. But, you know, the statement that you began at the top from Leon Panetta indicates that, you know, the Obama administration is trying to use the kind of most worst case, the worst case scenario of Israel attacking Iran as kind of a leverage to get Iran back to the negotiating table. So again, the Obama administration in some sense sees itself in the middle between Israel and its extreme position and Iran and its denial that it is even interested in a military nuclear program. Now, that middle position is complicated by domestic politics in this country. If it weren't for the Republicans, either as candidates or in Congress, making noises about Iran, then perhaps President Obama could kind of hew to this middle-of-the-road position. However, it's been the case for the last 3 years, and certainly even when Obama was running for president, that the Republicans and even some of his Democratic opponents have tried to paint him as being, you know, the appeaser in chief, that he will reach out his hand to America's adversaries without even paying much attention to what U.S. national interests are or to the lies and deceit that characterize our adversaries' positions. That, of course, is not true. It wasn't true when Obama was running for president, and it hasn't been true for the last 3 years. Nevertheless, that is a kind of position that Obama desperately does not want to have pinned to him in an election year, especially when so few points separate him from his Republican adversaries. So this is the one foreign policy issue that the Republicans can seize on and make themselves seem somehow more hawkish than the president. After all, Obama has basically taken national security off the table as a election year issue by, you know, killing Osama bin Laden, conducting a major, you know, drone offensive in Pakistan and several other countries, by surging in Afghanistan, by successfully bringing troops home from Iraq. In other words, there aren't a lot of issues that the Republicans can say, hey, this guy is not doing the right thing on foreign policy. Iran is that issue. And so that's why they're trying to make it seem as though President Obama is somehow weak on this issue by appeasing Iran. And so, you know, they've all said that they would keep, of course, all options on the table. Now, that's, of course, also what the president has said.
In his State of the Union, yes.
Some of the Republicans have gone even further. Gingrich, of course, saying that he would back assassinating nuclear scientists in Iran. And, of course, there have been scientists that have been assassinated inside Iran, so this is not an empty boast. So I think that pressure coming from the Republican Party, both in Congress and, again, as presidential candidates, makes it more difficult for President Obama to back down should Israel launch a strike or should tensions escalate between the United States and Iran, for instance, in the Persian Gulf.
Very complex, very scary. A lot of real threats, this saber-rattling can sometimes get out of control. And Obama has certainly had to, you know, as we mentioned during his State of the Union, he said that, quote, he will take no option off the table. Politically necessary, tough talk. Obviously, he's trying to avoid a war. How does it look domestically if Obama accepts a nuclear-armed Iran? And you know, it seems that the Republicans are just frothing at the mouth to say that, yes, President Obama will accept Iran with nuclear weapons. Is there political maneuvering room around that issue?
Well, there certainly is, I think, on the Republican side, but I don't think there's much prospect of that happening before the elections. the best guesses from, again, the U.S. intelligence community is that if Iran were to go full speed ahead on its kind of weaponizing its nuclear program, it wouldn't have a weapon to test until 2015 or so. So this would not be an issue in the current presidential election. If Obama were to be elected for a second term, it would be an issue he'd have to face in his second term. But in that case, it would be very similar to what George Bush faced with North Korea. Your listeners might remember that North Korea was not a nuclear power when George W. Bush took office in 2000. But after several years of basically ignoring North Korea or castigating it, including it in the Axis of Evil, North Korea just basically said, okay, forget about it. You know, we're not going to abide by the agreed framework. You're not abiding by the agreed framework that we signed in 1994. And it went ahead and it tested a nuclear weapon in 2006, in the second term. And that could have been a political issue for the Democrats. They chose, of course, not to. And it turns out, of course, that Obama has followed at least that initial approach of the Bush administration by ignoring North Korea for most of its term, although we expect negotiations to begin again next month. And it didn't pose that much of a political albatross, at least for the Republicans. It didn't
not at
represent
all,
a major kind of electoral issue in 2008. Iran, it might be a bigger issue if Iran were to test a nuclear weapon, in part because Israel cares more about that than Israel cares about North Korea's nuclear weapon. And so it has much more of a domestic impact here. And the question, if we were to take Israel out of the equation, we might ask, well, okay, Iran has some kind of residual nuclear capacity. We're not sure, you know, say in 2015 it would test a rough nuclear weapon. How would that change things? Would it dramatically change the balance of power in the region? Would it change the balance of power in the Middle East? It's possible that it would, but not in Iran's favor. In other words, the two countries that have been jostling for greatest influence in Iran recently, that being India and China. India just recently passed China as the largest consumer of Iranian oil. I don't think either China or India would be particularly happy if Iran actually tested a nuclear weapon, and it might kind of solidify, finally, the opposition to the current regime in Iran. It might also increase domestic discontent with that regime as the sanctions bite harder. So acquiring nuclear weapon might actually be the worst thing that the current regime in Iran could do in terms of preserving its own longevity as an Islamic republic.
Fascinating. Reality is always more complex than the simplistic fiction that gets painted here in America by both sides. Now, some people say that Iran's real crisis, as you were talking about, the pressure, political pressure from India, and sometimes I think America thinks, well, we're the only big guys on the block that can push anybody around. But as you point out, India is quite big and powerful, as is China. But there's a real crisis, a political internal crisis, a crisis perhaps of legitimacy even. It's a repressive government, I believe, at least all I'm seeing, you know, denying basic human rights. The elections of, I think this was 2009, were really questionable as to whether they were legitimate elections. And there were thousands of people in the streets of Iran, which I would think would be just a tad risky for those individuals, the green movement there. How might that movement be affected by increased sanctions against Iran and threats of attack from the United States and from the State of Israel? Here is this burgeoning protest movement, as we've seen in so many different countries before, that if a country is threatened, people put aside their differences and all stand up together. So might, you know, all the saber rattling by Israel with the help of the Republicans in America not actually strengthen the power of Ahmadinejad?
As you point out, the Green Movement, I think, was an important kind of signal to the outside world that we have a very, very diverse set of actors and a diverse spectrum of opinion inside Iran. But I think we would be mistaken to believe that the Green Movement represents the majority of public opinion in Iran today, in part because even though there was no doubt election year irregularities inside Iran, and that's been documented by election observers, by folks on the ground. But it wasn't so dramatic as to probably change the results of the election. Mm. Ahmadinejad remains quite popular, especially in poorer areas of the country and poorer areas of the major cities. And the Green Movement, although it does attract a lot of support from Iran's middle class and from its intelligentsia, is not as widespread or popular as its movement leaders expected at that time. And they themselves have said that they miscalculated in terms of the degree of their support. So that's one important point. Second point is on the nuclear program, regardless of political positions within Iran, you'll find that virtually everybody believes that Iran has the right to have a civilian nuclear capability. So that's a kind of point of consensus within Iran. And there's a lot of resentment against the outside world for trying to kind of pressure Iran to abandon it or to somehow restrain that program. So regardless of who might win, for instance, in the subsequent election, I think we're still going to have a lot of disagreement between Iran and the outside world about its nuclear program. In terms of the effect of sanctions, you know, sanctions tend to have a rally around the flag effect, unless they're very, very specifically focused on an elite. And with Iran, they're not focused on the elite. The effects of sanctions have hit across the board in Iran in terms of cost of energy, cost of foodstuffs, and so forth. And so that creates a lot of resentment, and it also boosts the popularity of the ruling government, which presents itself as a kind of the defender of Iranian interests in the international community. So sanctions can have kind of the opposite of their intended effect, which would be to, of course, decrease the amount of support internally for the ruling government. However, if part of the reason why, you know, the sanctions are not having the complete effect that they're intended to have is because there are a lot of countries that are basically not honoring those sanctions. And I mentioned China and India, but they're not the only ones. Of course, Russia, Turkey, also major powers that, you know, want to deal with Iran for energy reasons, but also because it's an important regional actor. The United States is far away from this region, and it gets its oil and energy from other sources. And in part, the United States has the luxury of not dealing with Iran, but these other countries don't perceive that they have such a luxury. So at this stage, at least, the sanctions are not having the effect of kind of bringing down the economy dramatically, but they are having the effect of pissing off a lot of people inside the country across the political spectrum and across economic classes.
I have to think of Cuba and how the Castro regime, both Fidel and Raul, probably owe their existence to economic sanctions placed on it by the U.S. There might be much greater resistance. It rarely works. Now, there's another aspect that's happening in this area and geopolitics of the region, and there's a lot going on there. Iraq and Iran have not always had the best of relations, to put it mildly. What about Syria? Right now, it's pretty hot in Syria. There's a lot of resistance, at least what we're seeing here, tremendous popular resistance. Where does Iran fit in with the government of Assad there and with regard to the people out on the streets there? And how might this affect Israel and the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important question. And here we have, you know, a kind of competition for influence, as I mentioned before. Turkey has basically abandoned Assad. There had been quite good relations between Turkey and Syria prior to the Arab Spring breaking out. And in fact, it was one of kind of the tenets of Turkey's evolving foreign policy that it was going to kind of really have a rapprochement with Syria, which is, of course, on its southern border, boost trade, and really kind of cement Turkey's position in the Middle East, in what was formerly Ottoman Empire territory. But that changed with the Arab Spring, and Turkey kind of realized that before the United States, that it could not really sanction or could not accept the previous relationships it had with authoritarian governments in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, and so forth. And when there were people fleeing from the repression in Syria, fleeing across the border into Turkey, when there were kind of expatriate organizations that were coming together to form a shadow government and even a shadow army, Turkey saw this as an opportunity, basically, to have a consistent position with Syria as it had with the democracy movements throughout the Middle East. So this created, you know, an enormous kind of cleavage between what had previously been two allies. Iran, on the other hand, has provided arms to the Syrian government. Has, you know, seen the current government there as a kind of bulwark for Iranian influence in the region. Sees the uprisings against the Syrian government as the same kind of Sunni-associated resistance that it has opposed elsewhere. So this is a major kind of regional cleavage that has emerged. I think that we might very well see, you know, a kind of a proxy war take place within Syria. Of course, we have a civil war that is already underway, but it hasn't quite achieved full-blown proxy war in which we have, for instance, Saudi Arabia supporting the rebels and Iran supporting government forces. So this is still on the horizon. The violence in Syria is terrible, but it could get a great deal worse.
We are talking with John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, and knows quite a bit about what's going on in the region. Now, again, you know, certainly Israel is, or at least Netanyahu and part of the Israeli government, the ultra-right, what seems to be in power now, the hawks, you know, they seem to want to attack, but you have said, you know, to stop a nuclear bomb, like, you know, with the belief that sometimes a preventive war can be a lesser evil than a policy of appeasement. But you said that in Iran, quote, there are good geopolitical, even theological reasons for not pursuing the bomb. I wonder if you could explain that and the significance of that observation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the theological reason, there have been several fatwas or declarations by Shiite clerics inside Iran saying that nuclear weapons are basically anti-Islamic and that the Iranian government should not pursue them for that reason. Now, of course, that didn't prevent Pakistan from pursuing nuclear weapons, but nevertheless, you know, it is important as a kind of guiding principle for the Shiite clerics to make statements like this, and they do have impact inside Iran. So that's on the theological side. On the geopolitical side, you know, right now, Iran courts its allies, Russia, China, India. These are big players. None of these countries are enthusiastic about seeing another nuclear power on their borders. It's potentially very destabilizing. And China worked pretty hard to try to persuade North Korea from pursuing a nuclear program, but North Korea basically didn't listen to it. India certainly is not not going to be eager to see yet another nuclear power in the region to kind of disrupt the calculus there. So Iran, if it decides to move forward with a nuclear program, has to make a very difficult decision about how much it's going to alienate these supporters, these superpower, emerging superpower supporters of Russia, China, and India. It might, again, it might turn out that if Iran moves past the point of no return, declares itself to be a nuclear power, it will lose that support from Russia, China, and India, even if those countries do need Iran's energy resources. But they might decide that the current kind of political dispensation inside Iran is not favorable, and they'll link up with the United States and other, the European Union, other international actors to isolate Iran more substantially than they've done previously.
And I would think the government of Iran is at least sophisticated enough to realize that.
It is, but you know, there are other reasons why a country pursues a nuclear program. In some cases, as was the case in India, you develop a kind of a political bureaucracy that's connected to the development of a nuclear program, and it's extremely difficult for that for any government to push back against that bureaucracy once it's created. The bureaucracy essentially creates a momentum of its own, and it establishes various benchmarks of success, and it's extremely difficult to roll that back. So that in the case of India, even if you have someone who in George Fernandez, who is one of the leading anti-nuclear campaigners, when he becomes defense minister, he presides over the India's joining the nuclear club, because he, you know, becomes part of this kind of political bureaucracy committed to a nuclear weapon. It doesn't really matter what his personal views are. Likewise, it doesn't really matter in some sense what Ahmadinejad's personal views are, or the views of the small coterie of advisors around him. Iran has, over the years, created this political bureaucracy, and it has a momentum and an institutional imperative of its own. So again, you know, Ahmadinejad or his advisors might make very careful calculations about what might happen geopolitically or in relationship with the United States and Israel in terms of the development of the nuclear program. They're essentially on a horse that is not entirely under their control. The horse could break free and gallop off in any direction.
And the horse on the other side, Netanyahu, he's been blustering about this for quite some time. He seems really, really eager to, you know, let the missiles fly and attack Iran somehow. What kind of political wiggle room does he have now? Is he like that bureaucracy that, like, you know, it's got its own momentum? Does he have enough wiggle room to not attack, or might it be too politically risky for him, and it might be better for him to start a war than to change his attitude?
Well, there are two windows here. One window I mentioned is the zone of immunity. In other words, the degree to which Iran has developed past the point at which any outside power can destroy the nuclear program. The other window is this election year, and there's speculation that Netanyahu, were he to launch an attack, would do it during this election year before you know, either Obama were reelected or another Republican took office, because he feels that this is the time he could get the United States to back an attack that Obama, especially in an election year, would not be able to back down, that
right.
he'd be pushed into that position by the Republican opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the golden moment. So you have these two windows, and it's possible that this second window, the window of political opportunity, influences the interpretation of the first window, namely how far along Iran's nuclear program really is, since that's a matter of interpretation anyway, in the absence of clear information one way or another. So whether Netanyahu can back down from his more aggressive positions that he's articulated over the last couple of years, that's a good question. I mean, if he has to, he can. I mean, he can always say, well, look, we passed the zone of immunity, and we realize that it's not possible to take out the nuclear program, just physically impossible to do so. He could also say, you know, he can use plenty of hawks within the Israeli political system, former Mossad people and so forth, as cover. You know, they can come out and say, look, you know, the ramifications of an attack are too dire, and would have the opposite effect than we would want. So he can use those for political cover if necessary as well. So there are ways for Netanyahu to back down and still save face. Whether he's interested in doing that is another question, since, you know, this is part of his image, this is part of his background, and he is in it not just for, you know, his own kind of personal consolidation of power, but he and his group want to push Israel irrevocably down a certain path. Their vision of, you know, an aggressive actor in the Middle East, and an attack on Iran would kind of put a time date stamp on that new identity for Israel.
Boy, he'd sure look tough in the saddle now, wouldn't he? Image is so important, unfortunately. And the U.S. has a significant presence in the region. I believe there are bases all around the former Persia. And, you know, there's this little Straits of Hormuz there, and the U.S. fleet is there moving its big ships in and out. I wonder about what the danger may be of a minor malfunction in one of those speedboats that regularly harass the U.S. fleet. You know, some minor malfunction, like, you know, say one of their little outboard engines has a problem and gets stuck there and some collision happens or something like that. I wonder what danger they may be in some little, oops, miscalculation there developing into a war.
Well, there definitely is that possibility, especially since we don't have really any mechanisms between the United States and Iran that are designed to kind of prevent conflict from escalating, you know, no hotlines. And that's a problem, and it does allow for a situation in which what might ordinarily be a minor collision or a minor conflict to escalate. We should remember, of course, that the United States and Iran have had major incidents in the past, with the United States shooting down an Iranian airline, mistakenly believed to be military when in fact it was civilian.
Right.
And so we did survive, you know, major incidents like that. So it's not inevitable that we'll have some kind of a fracas in the Persian Gulf that it escalates. But if we're in a situation in which the two sides are edging closer to outright conflict, and with Israel as a wild card, you're right. Some collision in the Persian Gulf, Straits of Hormuz, could in fact prove the spark that ignites a wider conflagration.
Well, I hesitate to ask this. How concerned are you, John Pfeffer, about there being a war? Do you think we can make it to November of 2012 without some explosive war? Can Israel be, you know, calm down, Netanyahu, like, cooled off a bit? Or Or do you think Israel really, really, really is going to attack?
Well, you know, my hope, and this is a hope.
Right.
Not really, it's not bolstered by any real information. But my hope is that the United States government right now is making all sorts of threats to Israel quietly, because it would not do so publicly.
Right.
And it is threatening Israel that if it does go ahead with such an attack, not only will the United States not support that attack, but it would penalize Israel in other ways, withdrawing military assistance, for instance, or abandoning any pretense at working as a broker for Middle East peace. That's my hope, that, that the Obama administration is deploying every stick it has preemptively against Israel. And certainly the leaks of that the U.S. government is engaged in to kind of expose Israel's more aggressive plans, I think that, too, is an indication of some thinking within Washington of how to defuse Israel's plans as much as possible. So that's my hope, and my hope is that, you know, we can survive between February and November, and we can close that political window of opportunity, and hopefully the voters of Israel at some point will be able to weigh in and also change the direction that the Israeli government has been going in over the last couple of years with Netanyahu.
We can hope. Now, if people want to follow more of what you're doing in the Foreign Policy in Focus, there must be some website to which you can direct them.
Absolutely. We're at fpif.org, foreignpolicyinfocus.org.
Thank you so much for being with us. John Pfeffer, Foreign Policy in Focus. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Come here.